From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, how do you describe the scale of an ongoing disaster? If you were reporting this week on the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the first thing you would have to do is convey the scope of the event. And it's been a struggle because there are so many things to measure, starting with, but not limited to, size.
Here's an image of the spill taken from space.
Gushing 42,000 gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico every day, creating a slick about the size of Rhode Island.
Yeah. This slick is the size of Delaware. There's no other way to put it.
A growing blob of oil, now the size of Jamaica, menaces five coastal states.
Jackie Savitz, a senior scientist with Oceana, an international ocean conservation association, says that describing the scale of the leak in geographical terms, or how it looks from outer space, gives the public an incomplete understanding of the spill's true dimension.
It may paint a picture of an area on the surface of the ocean that's the size of Delaware, to the exclusion of all that area down below the surface, where lots of fish and other marine animals live who are also being exposed to the contamination. It might be more telling to think of it in terms of volume, like how many Olympic-sized pools is that, or how many stadiums would that be, or what lake might that be equivalent to?
Does the fact that we can see it from space actually convey anything meaningful?
Most people don't really have a sense of how far away space is. And even when you say it, I'm not really sure how far away you're talking about. Is it a satellite that's circling the Earth, or are you seeing it from the moon, right? There's a lot of space out there.
But one bit of media misdirection you think that's taking place is a focus on whether or not the oil spill will hit the coast.
Well, and I think the media means well in this case. But what it does is I think it leads people to think, okay, well, it's not a problem until it hits the coast. The truth is that there's a broad diversity of marine life that live in the area right where the spill is that have been exposed to toxic contaminants now for almost 2 weeks. Endangered species like sea turtles, marine mammals like bottlenose dolphins. So if we only think about what's going to happen when it hits the coast, we really haven't characterized the devastation that's happening in our ocean right now as we speak and continuing to happen.
And even preventing it from hitting the coast requires taking some risk with the environment, right? I mean, in order to make that slick small enough so that you couldn't see it from space, you'd have to drop toxic chemicals on it to get it off the surface.
Exactly. The use of chemicals that they call dispersants, they're breaking up the oil so that it dissolves into the water. So maybe it doesn't wash up on the coast. It's not going to create those ugly pictures of birds and globs of oil on the beach as often, but it doesn't mean that we've solved the problem or the problem's really gone away. It's still there. Really, whether it's a good idea or not depends on whether you're a seabird or a fish.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brooke.
Jackie Savitz is a senior scientist with the conservation organization Oceana. Of course, there's yet another dimension of the spill to consider, the political one. What's the scale of that? How much of the blame for it falls at the feet of government? For commentators on the political right, Katrina is the ideal metric to apply to the government's response to the spill.
Most people would assume that the federal government didn't get involved because they thought BP was going to take care of it. But it's the same thing with Katrina. Bush said he didn't get involved because he's waiting for Louisiana to call him in.
That's a perfect analogy.
Look, this is unconscionable that they had a plan in place. They would burn off the oil in an instant like this. The administration didn't do it. Criticism coming from the Sierra Club that Obama's response to the oil spill was worse than Katrina.
That damn oil slick. Obama's Katrina.
Hurricane reporter Mark Schlefstein covered Katrina for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Seen from the Louisiana perspective, he says, there's not much of a comparison.
This is Katrina light at best. What happened during Katrina was that the disaster had known consequences. In fact, Bush was shown a video presentation by the director of the National Hurricane Center that showed that the entire city of New Orleans would be flooded if the thing went in as a Category 5. But despite that information in advance of Hurricane Katrina, there were not significant efforts made to assure that people would be able to be rescued immediately. The difference here is that this is a much slower kind of a disaster event, and the result of that was that there actually was time to deal with things as they moved along. I really don't understand how people could say the administration did not immediately respond to this incident. I still don't see that there's a real way of comparing the two. They're just not the same.
The only comparison that you see is that in both cases, there was a failure by authorities to anticipate and prepare for a potential disaster.
Right. And the problem here is that they had the lesson learned from Katrina. For instance, the Army Corps of Engineers is building its risk lessons from Katrina into everything that it now does as an agency. It was expected that those same risk lessons would be delivered to other agencies of the federal government. Obviously, in this case, they were not delivered to the Minerals Management Service. They did not really take seriously the potential for a catastrophic event occurring that far offshore.
So if I could ask you to function as a media critic here for a moment rather than as a reporter, what do you think the motive is then behind pundits and news organizations using phrases like Obama's Katrina?
Well, it's easy to say that. I think it's very clear that saying Obama's Katrina is certainly a marketing tool that works very well. I just don't think it works in this particular instance.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Schlefstein is a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And finally, reporters have to summon up language to convey the environmental impact. But how do you describe the scope of something that is still unknown? Some reporters opt for prose that matches the color of the spill. Purple.
Meanwhile, Gulf communities are racing for an economic and environmental catastrophe.
The devastation is already occurring.
I expect this will be the biggest oil spill in the world by far.
The leak takes months to plug. As some have predicted, this could be the worst environmental disaster in our nation's history.
And given the rarity of such enormous spills, reporters reach back to a past calamity as a reference and a reminder of an accident that burned the image of rainbow-slicked shorelines and slimed seabirds into America's consciousness, the Exxon Valdez disaster of 1989.
It could be worse than the Valdez 20 years ago unless they can figure out how to stop this leakage.
It threatens to eclipse the devastation caused by the Exxon Valdez.
This BP spill, if it keeps up at the current rate in 50 days, it will be worse than the Exxon Valdez.
Charles Woolforth covered the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989. He says that both the purple prose and the Valdez comparisons are too much too soon.
I think that the media kind of got a little ahead of itself. I saw stories that were saying it would be worse than the Exxon Valdez and calling it a catastrophe pretty early on. And the fact is, we really don't know how bad it is yet. And one really dramatic difference between this spill and the Exxon Valdez is that in the Exxon Valdez, you had over 11 million gallons dumped in 6 hours, just a few miles from shore. In this case, you have something around 200,000 gallons a day being dumped 50 miles away from shore. So in the Exxon Valdez, you had an enormous amount of oil that was, within 3 days, completely coasting an inland sea, essentially. And here you have oil that's pretty far offshore and it gets significantly degraded before it gets to shore. And it doesn't sound like, at least as we're talking today, we know it's bad, but it's just nowhere near on the scale of Exxon Valdez yet.
Woolforth says that reporters covering Valdez back in 89 did a pretty good job, given the obstacles posed by so unusual a story in so inaccessible a place.
So they were kind of at a loss in how to get out there, how to see it, how to evaluate what they're looking at. And they were covering a story that most of them had never covered before, because major oil spills don't happen that often. So there was a certain amount of exaggeration or erroneous coverage. But overall, they got it right. I mean, if you measure it by the impression that the public got, it was a huge environmental disaster, off the charts, really. And people got that word, and they understood it, and they appreciated, at least briefly, the fact that once you have an oil spill of this size, that there's really not that much you can do about it and that the devastation is horrendous.
In terms of impact, the media did its job, in your view. And in this case, do you think that the headline-grabbing nature of this coverage is doing the same job?
Well, one of the fears I have about the coverage is that if we dodge the bullet and if they are able to shut off the oil and the disaster isn't nearly as bad as Exxon Valdez, then it's kind of a cry wolf situation. It's, oh, look at those environmentalists exaggerating everything again. You can't trust them. So there's a real cost to saying it's a catastrophe before it is a catastrophe, even if it has very negative impacts that are very serious. If they're not as bad as you said they were going to be, then people kind of tend to discount them, whereas if they were encountering them without having that expectation, they might take them much more seriously. So I think it's important to be really careful about what has actually happened and what might happen, because it does have a huge political impact on how we're going to deal with the environmental issues in the future.
Charles, thank you very much.
Sure.
Charles Woolforth writes on the environment. His book, The Fate of Nature, comes out in June. The fate of the region in the wake of the spill is unknown. All of us hate unknowns. But with the future as murky as the Gulf of Mexico, any commentator who claims to offer clarity right now is only muddying the waters. Coming up, the press was all over the story of the foiled Times Square bomb plot.
As a matter of fact, my sources tell me that there were satellite trucks at the guy's house before the takedown.
Did all that coverage help the bomber? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. LendingTree, whose financial tools include Loan Coach, offering personalized advice for every step of the lending process at lendingtree.com. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The car bomb that failed to go off in New York City's Times Square last weekend is now a story with an ending. The man arrested, Faisal Shahzad, has admitted his role in the plot. But last Saturday, when the story broke, there weren't many details for the media to go on.
Right now in Times Square in New York City, there is an emergency evacuation in effect. This emergency investigation is following a small fire inside the back of a car where police initially reported seeing a package there.
Sunday morning, the mayor confirmed that the fire was indeed from a bomb that had failed to go off. The chase was on. Details quickly emerged about the car. It was a Nissan Pathfinder, and the previous owner, a woman named Peggy from Connecticut. Pretty soon, a suspect was on the police and the media's radar. And then they lost him.
On Monday afternoon, Faisal Shahzad, wanted and under surveillance, gave law enforcement the slip. Sources tell CBS News the surveillance team lost him in traffic as he drove south toward New York's Kennedy Airport.
And that's where investigators caught up with him, on a plane headed to Dubai.
The plane had actually pulled back from the gate, was recalled to the gate. He was removed from the flight, along with at least two other passengers.
An ending worthy of an episode of 24. But reporter Bob Henley, who's been reporting on the car bomb story for our producing station WNYC, says that is just one of the things you think you know about this story that didn't actually happen. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the number one thing is that the plane was literally rolling away from the gate when the authorities came in to catch him.
Right, exactly. We're driven in the broadcast media by tape, visuals, and sound. And so we had a real payoff here with this image of the Emirates flight rolling and taxiing away, evidently to Dubai and to a clean getaway for the alleged bomber. Even though that didn't actually happen, if you go and ask people, depending on what they read or what they saw, they believe that indeed they called back the plane and deplaned the individual. What actually happened was customs officials were able to get him off the plane before the jetway was pushed away, and it did pull away, and they called it back to pull off two other individuals who were suspicious. Those two individuals were released.
You say that what the media have done in order to stay on top of this story, many media outlets, is to basically quote other people's anonymous sources, say from the AP, without really knowing who they are.
Right. This is a derivative anonymous source, and that's problematic. In our news organization, if one of my colleagues says this is an anonymous source, they tell me who it is, I have faith and trust in that. I understand the nature of the transaction. Let's be honest. Anonymous sourcing is a transaction. And the payoff in that transaction is I'll give you the narrative line without fingerprints. You can be oh so smart. And yet you have to own up to people when it doesn't go right. And what's missing from the story is the role the media played in helping perhaps to give the suspect situational awareness about how imminent his own capture was. We had circumstances where the media was actually going into the guy's garbage to get leads. I mean, once it was released that this part of Connecticut was a focal point, the media is going to do what it's going to do. But then you have to ask yourself, to what degree is the media's desire to get the story putting us at risk?
How do we know that it was the media's attention that caused the suspect to drop out of sight for
a
while?
We really don't. And I'll be fair. I just think that it has to be included in the narrative line, that if you're going to talk about the FBI and Department of Justice and the Joint Terrorism Task Force losing the suspect, there has to be an accounting, like a good scientist. You know, a scientist tries to account for their role in the experiment. And we need to do that. We need to own that, to be honest and transparent.
Well, let's talk about that. We do know that the police initially closed off the scene, called it a police action, wasn't sharing a lot of information with the media. Where did things go wrong?
It's funny because I was going to pick up my daughter in Midtown, and so I was using the radio to get traffic situational awareness, and I heard police activity downtown, and it kept growing. There was no description of what the nature of that police activity was. And so I called DCPI, which is the press office for the police department, and I got a kind of, well, we think it's a car fire, but it could be an improvised explosive device. Not very clear. I was like, oh, really? Okay. At that point, I began to realize that they were using this control of information, I would say, entirely appropriately, because they were trying to carefully evacuate the portions of Times Square that were affected by a potential blast.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very easy now to look back and realize that, well, the bomb was, you know, disabled. But at the time, they had to control the information. But where things got funky was as we get into Sunday into Monday, we now have the national media trying to be cops. So CNN sends a satellite truck to all the places where the law enforcement people have been working. What ends up happening is different officials from law enforcement feeding their favorite media people these details. That can be deadly because this is a working police operation. So to the degree to which you're hearing 8 or 9 hours before the individual is apprehended, with the specificity details like that there was a transaction on Craigslist for a 1993 Nissan Pathfinder, well, that's a big heads up, don't you think? And how important is it for the public to know about that when they still haven't apprehended the individual? As a matter of fact, my sources tell me that there were satellite trucks at the guy's house before the takedown. So in essence, the media itself compromised the operation and they'll never own it.
Bob, thank you very much.
Thanks.
WNYC's Bob Henley. Faisal Shahzad had just returned from Pakistan, where reportedly he underwent terrorist training by the Taliban. That struggle continues in Afghanistan, where America is waging a war not just to wrest territory from the Taliban, but to win hearts and minds and fight the plague of suicide bombings and IEDs. To that end, the U.S. military has launched a new ad campaign in Afghanistan in partnership with a local ad agency, Lapis. Here's the English version of one of the ads Lapis produced for the new campaign.
What will we make of this child? Will we teach him to take lives or to save them? If we want a new Afghanistan, we have to build one for this new Afghan. Because he is new life for us all.
Jahid Mosseini is the CEO of the Mobi Group, the parent company of Lapis. Jahid, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell me about some of the past efforts by the U.S. military to get their message across to the people of Afghanistan?
Firstly, it's just a guess because their ads are never branded as U.S. military or U.S. efforts. There's a lot of ads that are going through for counterterrorism. And generally, they're very prescriptive, very literal, and there's violence and there's bits of shooting in there, etc.
And did they work?
they don't necessarily change people's perceptions. And then because of the amount of propaganda that's been thrown at people in the country over the last 30 years, I think people are fairly cynical when it comes to those kinds of ads.
And so rather than doing the literal approach, they've turned to Lapis, to your company, to try something new. Your company employs symbols and icons to send a subtler message, right?
On this campaign, there were two core areas they were looking at. They were looking at the branding and positioning of an Afghan National Army, and then secondly, looking at governance and development. In terms of the Afghan National Army, it was basically trying to imbue a sense of pride within the military itself and also with the population, link it in with the warrior poets of old, protectors of the people, picking up a gun not because they wanted to, but because they had to in order to protect society.
How are you attacking the issue of development?
It was very, very simple, using, again, very iconic basic imagery, using babies. A baby is something that everyone identifies with because it's calm, it's soft, it's not telling you to do anything. And oddly enough, you know, even for us, like as proprietors of a media company, stopping you to think and think, okay, well, you know, we're shaping the future of the generations to come.
What's the feedback been from the viewers? Has the message gotten through?
The feedback has been fairly positive. We've done a number of focus groups and people were quite happy with it. They were thinking about it. They saw that it was positive. So far it's been good.
Where are your ads appearing?
This current campaign, it's looking at more the eastern part of the country. It's on television, on the national television, on billboards, on radio.
Is anybody criticizing you for producing propaganda for the U.S. military?
So far, we haven't got any criticism, but for me, the most important thing is that we didn't see much of this as being specifically propaganda. You know, one of the reasons we were able to take it on is it wasn't a propaganda piece. It wasn't about taking sides. It wasn't about Afghans having to choose sides. It was driving people to think and take a step back. And you have to also understand, in our country, 99% of the people are just normal, everyday human beings that want to get on with their lives, want to have security, want to have jobs.
Some have credited the Taliban with having a much more effective public relations machine than anything the U.S. military came up with. Do you agree with that?
I think they've got a very different message to what the military is trying to convey. They want to send a message that the country is kind of being invaded or being occupied. It's just it's a fairly simple message that they're there, they have a presence, they have an impact, they have an influence. So in that sense, it's much easier to tell people if you cooperate, you might be killed, etc.
That message sounds pretty effective.
Yeah, and it would be. But again, there's very different messages. It's hard to do messaging for development. You're not going in there and promising people a new home. If you went in there doing an ad saying every Afghan's getting a new house, it becomes much more simple.
Whenever we've talked about Hearts and Minds campaigns anywhere, it always seems to boil down to ads can only take you so far. And in fact, ads will take you nowhere if the policies of government don't reflect what the ads are trying to convey. Do you find that the policy is consistent with your ads?
If you're talking to people and you're telling them that we're bringing peace, but at the same time there are people being killed, obviously then that becomes a problem. So you have to be very careful in terms of how you do advertising and what you promise.
So in the current environment, how much impact do you see your ads having?
I think it plays some positive roles, otherwise we wouldn't be involved. You can't have an ad campaign that changes the country. This is a small part and a very large problem. Fundamentally, in Afghanistan, no foreign power is going to be able to make the changes. It will have to be the people. We need to decide where our future lies.
Jahid, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jahid Mohseni is the CEO of the Mobi Group, the parent company of Lapis. Throughout the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, vocal music provided a lively soundtrack, from four-part harmonies urging endurance to thundering calls for action. Among the latter was a chant with the refrain, "The cowards are scared, shoot, shoot, shoot the Boer, these dogs are raping." Boer is slang for white South Africans. It's derived from the Dutch word for farmer. The song might have remained a relic of history, but for Julius Malema, leader of the youth wing of the ruling African National Congress Party. At a rally in March, he led the crowd in a rendition of the chant.
Shoot to kill! Kill our man! Shoot to kill! Hamasa!
Malema was condemned by opposition parties and human rights groups, and two separate South African courts ruled the song unconstitutional hate speech and banned it. But the ANC defended the chant as part of its history and heritage and vowed to appeal. Shoot the Boer is certainly not unique among South African protest songs. One YouTube clip shows Nelson Mandela at a memorial service for fallen ANC activists in 1992 raising his fist while his supporters sing a song. It goes, "We have pledged ourselves to kill them, the whites." The current South African president, Jacob Zuma, used another militant anthem as his campaign song a year ago. Its words, "Umshini Wam," translate to "Bring me my machine gun." But President Zuma and much of the ANC's top leadership have done an about-face, telling their rank and file to stop singing Shoot the Boer and sending Malema before an internal disciplinary committee, whose hearings began this week. Later this month, Malema will begin court proceedings aimed at tagging his chanting once and for all as hate speech. Last week, meanwhile, Time magazine named him in its list of least influential people of 2010 under the heading of morons. But despite the political dust-up, Jane Duncan, who teaches media studies at Rhodes University in South Africa, says the singing of Malema and his supporters has less to do with racial hatred and more to do with bubbling socioeconomic tensions. And according to one study last year, South Africa has supplanted Brazil as having the world's highest income disparity. What's more, she says, the song doesn't even fulfill the South African Constitution's three criteria for hate speech.
First of all, you need to prove that the speech constitutes advocacy of hatred. It needs to be on the basis of one of four recognizable grounds: race, gender, ethnicity, or religion. And thirdly, it must constitute incitement to cause harm.
It strikes me that since Boers represent white farmers, there's the racial component, and the call to kill them would be an incitement to cause harm. So why wouldn't those things fall under the legal definition of hate speech?
I don't think that anyone in their right minds would have construed the singing of the song as an incitement to kill particular Boers. Rather, I think it was always understood that the song was not necessarily literally meant, that it was a metaphorical call to arms against the system of apartheid.
For certain white South Africans, there are legitimate fears, aren't there? There have been some 3,000-odd murders of farmers since the end of apartheid in 1994. The majority of those, I believe, are white farmers.
There has been a link that has been drawn between the farm murders and the chanting of the song. I think while it could be argued that the song feeds into an environment of hostility against farmers, there are many other factors that feed into that climate as well. The fact that farmers often exploit farm workers, that farms are often highly exposed, which makes it easier for farm attacks to take place, are also factors, because we're unable to draw causal links between these farm attacks and the chanting of the song. We need to be very careful about advocating for censorship of the song.
Okay, so if it isn't technically hate speech, isn't it still hateful speech?
In 2004, an Equality Act was drafted that actually broadened the definition of hate speech to include not just harmful speech, but hurtful speech as well. Now, it's obviously very difficult to identify what constitutes hurtful speech, which means that you can land up catching in the net of hate speech all kinds of speech that people may feel to be objectionable, but that doesn't necessarily result in people wanting to harm other people. And that's quite dangerous for our democracy, because it can create an environment where people are reluctant to engage on very sensitive issues.
In May of 2008, starting in poor township neighborhoods in Johannesburg, there was a wave of attacks aimed at Zimbabwean and other African immigrants that left over 60 people dead and thousands displaced in refugee camps. At the time, some suggested that the immigrants were a scapegoat for general frustration with the government. Do you think that it's possible that's why Malema and his violent protest songs have gained traction, that it's an indirect outlet for people's frustration?
Yes, I certainly think that a lot of black people feel disappointed about the manner and pace of transformation of South African society. I have questions about whether Julius Malema is the best person to give a voice to these kinds of frustrations. I think that he has been chanting the song in order to distract attention away from media investigations of his own personal affairs. But in the process of stopping him from chanting the song, we risk closing down the space for people who are more genuine representatives from saying what they need to say. If we drive these kinds of messages underground, then we run the risk of not becoming aware of the buildup of tensions in our society.
Jane Duncan, thank you very much.
All right, it's a pleasure.
Jane Duncan is a professor of media and information society at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, South Africa. Coming up, the internet's magical memes. Keyboard playing cat, David after dentist, and of course, Hitler. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last weekend, the internet showed up for a happening at MIT. It was an A-list of viral celebrities, like the father and son behind the David After Dentist video, viewed by 58 million people, in which Big David films Little David after he's been drugged up.
I feel funny. Is this real life?
Yeah, this is real life.
Also appearing, the owner of the original keyboard cat. You know, the one with the blue onesie playing piano, seen by gazillions.
I had no job, and I had a lot of time, and a cat, and a keyboard, and a camera. And I'm not trying to be funny, it's just that that's what I had.
They rubbed shoulders with the people behind inexplicably blockbuster sites like Regretsy, which mocks the worst handmade items on the shopping site Etsy, and Lamebook, which mocks the users of Facebook. Also, the now essential Urban Dictionary. The event was RaffleCon 2, and radio producer Benjamin Walker is here to explain exactly what a RaffleCon is. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Brooke. So Raffle is one of the internet's oldest acronyms. It means rolling on the floor laughing, but it's really just shorthand for stuff you like online. So RaffleCon is a convention/conference all about popular and famous stuff on the internet, or internet memes. RaffleCon is organized by these two young Harvard geniuses, Tim Huang and Christina Xu. And, you know, Harvard hosts a lot of big-time real internet conferences, but Christina told me some of these left something to be desired.
We go to conferences about internet culture, and what we found repeatedly was that as someone from the internet generation, we constantly were kind of wincing and being like, ooh, that's not quite right, you know, they're not quite getting it. And so we thought, what better way to help that dialogue than to invite the people who actually are the ones who are creating these things and get their voices out.
So how high does the voltage go when you put a bunch of internet stars into the same room?
Well, what everyone is trying to understand, and I'm talking academics, marketers, scientists, radio show hosts, is why certain things go viral on the internet. Pretty much every meme at RaffleCon has something accidental about it. Take David After Dentist. David's dad simply pulled over to the side of the road to videotape his still high after dentist son, who was questioning the nature of reality.
I really love this one.
Why is this happening to me?
It's okay, bud. It's just from the medicine. Okay?
Is this going to be forever?
No. No, it won't be forever.
And listen to college student Brian Govern tell me how he came to write his Amazon review for a t-shirt with three wolves and a moon on it.
One night, I was laying in bed looking for school books from Amazon.com, and somehow Amazon's recommendation engine suggested I might like this Three Wolf Moon t-shirt. It seemed absolutely ridiculous to me because it had nothing to do with books or law or any of the things I'd searched for. And I remembered somebody I knew when I was younger who really, really was into Wolf t-shirts. So I kind of imagined what that person would be nowadays, like what he'd look like, how he's grown, and I wrote the review from his viewpoint.
The review Brian wrote suggested this shirt had magical powers for the Walmart-loving trailer park resident who was supposedly writing it, and it inspired over 2,000 more reviews. But even more importantly, the shirt is still an Amazon top seller.
Okay, so he was writing in the voice of a trailer park person. That sounds kind of snarky to begin with. Are we talking about some sort of orgy of irony coming to roost online?
Well, this Three Wolf Moon t-shirt was made by this Bulgarian artist, Antonia Nesev, and she was at RaffleCon too, and she made the point of explaining that her shirt is not ironic.
She meant it.
Absolutely. And Brooke, I believe that if this shirt had been made ironically, this whole thing never would have happened.
Huh.
All these memes do have an authenticity to them.
David After Dentist, he is sincerely confused.
Yes, in fact, they've made a few other videos that they're just not as good.
They're not as good.
No.
And if we go back to the keyboard playing cat, the cat looks sincerely fascinated with the keyboard.
Absolutely. I think this is the RaffleCon meme that explains this authenticity thing the best. At the core is Charlie Schmidt's cat, Fatso, playing the keyboard.
This is a video of my cat playing a real short, really cool riff that's original music. She wrote it herself, and she clearly has an attitude.
Charlie recorded this in the late 80s, and he put it online when he discovered YouTube. And then this kid, Brad O'Farrell, found this video and used it to create the meme, Play Him Off Keyboard Cat, basically taking Fatso to comment on all kinds of people doing stupid stuff. A person falling down the stairs, a person, you know, running into a wall, a pet falling into the toilet. He created a template so anyone could take their own fail videos and attach the keyboard cat at the end so the cat is making a statement. And this went viral. There's, you know, thousands of these videos out there on the internet. But the most amazing thing about this story is that Brad O'Farrell was at RaffleCon 1 in 2008 as an intern. And he watched all these internet celebrities on stage being showered with attention, and he decided that the next time he would join their ranks. And he did it. He even wore a cat suit this time.
I figured I would fade into the crowd if I wasn't wearing an outfit after my panel, so at least I can be like the keyboard cat guy all weekend, which is what I came here for in the first place.
If this guy in a cat suit was able to figure out how to make a video go viral, what's going to stop the makers of Pepsi or Volkswagen or any other marketer from doing the same?
Absolutely. There was a lot of talk at RaffleCon about, you know, data mining and statistics and some of the science that's being done with our behaviors online. And the talk is, it's not if meme science, it's when.
So we're that predictable. That makes me sad.
Me too.
Benjamin Walker's radio show, Too Much Information, devotes a whole hour to RaffleCon. We'll link to his podcast at onthemedia.org. In 2005, a German movie called Der Untergang, or Downfall, was an Academy Award nominee for Best Foreign Language Film. It didn't win, but of all the films in the category that year, it may be the most watched, or at least one small part of it. Because a couple of years after the film's release, YouTube users began putting fake English subtitles on a four-minute scene in which Hitler, in his underground bunker, flies off the handle. In the movie, which is in German, Hitler is actually ranting about how his orders aren't being followed. But the new subtitles have him ranting about everything from losing his house during the mortgage crisis,
real estate only goes up,
to getting banned from Xbox Live.
I'm so desperate for a game console right now. I must be forced to go out and buy a goddamned PS3.
The Hitler meme, as it became known, flourished for years, with hundreds of Downfall videos viewed millions of times online. Flourished, that is, until last month, when Google, which owns YouTube, pulled the plug. Constantin Films, the German company that owns the rights to Downfall, said that the mock videos were a violation of its copyright. Those who had posted them were left wondering, what about fair use? Isn't parody protected under U.S. copyright law? We asked Electronic Frontier Foundation attorney Corinne McSherry.
Is it a fair use? Well, it's an entirely non-commercial use, which is one of the factors that courts would pay attention to. It's taking the original work and putting it to an entirely new purpose, distinct from that of the original work. A court would look at how much of the original work did you take, and did you take more than you needed to? Here you've got 4 minutes of a two-hour movie, and the bunker scene is sort of crucial to the parody and satire that happens in the subsequent work. And the final factor that's very important to courts is, have you harmed the market for the original work? I just can't see any conceivable way. Seems to me a very, very strong case that it's a fair use and therefore not an infringement of copyright.
This has been Google's deal with content providers all along. If they want something down, they'll take it down. Why did they strike that deal?
They want to say, look, we host content, but we don't want to be liable if any of that content is infringing. And if someone complains, fine, we take it down. We just make sure that there's options for users to challenge that and have the content be put back up.
So what are the options that users have?
What they can do is they can file a dispute, a notice back to YouTube saying, this material was taken down improperly, please put it back up. Then, according to YouTube, the material is put back up right away, and the copyright owner then has an option of sending a formal legal notice or not. So there's a series of escalating steps. The difficulty is that many users, number one, don't understand how the dispute system works. Secondly, users are concerned that if they challenge a takedown, even if they believe that their video is protected by fair use, that they might get sued.
Now, obviously, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for whom you work, believes very strongly in protecting fair use. So what do you see as the danger in having YouTube, by far the most popular video sharing site, more or less set this low standard by which content can be taken down?
We think it's a very serious danger. A copyright owner can essentially set the filter to just take down everything, even when they haven't even bothered to look at the material, consider whether it's protected by fair use, and in fact may not even care whether it's protected by fair use. The internet has been an extraordinary forum for new kinds of speech, some of it political, some of it just funny, some of it critical. And when you see mass takedowns like this, it sends a signal to creative people who are interested in doing different kinds of remixes that at any minute, something they've worked very hard on can be disappeared. And that's a terrible signal to be sending.
I've mentioned that you've seen a lot of these downfall videos. Do you have a favorite?
Well, unfortunately, some of my favorites have now been taken down, so I can't point anyone to them. But one of my favorites is entitled Hitler Reacts to Hitler Parodies Being Removed from YouTube. And it's very, very funny. And for anyone who goes and looks it up, watch to the end.
Corinne, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Corinne McSherry is senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Anti-Defamation League director Abraham Foxman was delighted when the videos came down. He said that they were offensive, that they trivialized not only the Holocaust, but World War II. Hitler, he said, is not a cartoon character, which raises an altogether different point. If Mark Twain was right and humor is tragedy plus time, then how much time needs to pass before we can all make fun of Hitler? Ron Rosenbaum, author of Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil, says that timing is tricky when it comes to the Führer. Welcome back to the show, Ron.
Thanks, Brooke. And actually, with all due respect, I have to disagree with Abe Foxman because I think the parodies were actually picking up something cartoonish and trivializing in the film itself. The film itself was an exculpation of the German people by making Hitler into a kind of comic psycho monster and thus blaming all the evil of the Holocaust on Hitler and the other people in the bunker. And the people who made parodies out of that were picking up on it and I think in some way critiquing it. There was a deeper truth in these parodies.
And so you're suggesting that that was perhaps an unconscious kind of meta commentary on a portrayal of Hitler. But of course, going right back to 1940, you have direct parodies of the man himself. Charlie Chaplin was trying to diminish the man in The Great Dictator, knock him down a peg.
Well, in fact, there's a school of historians that I think have a sharp take on this, which is that Chaplin's portrayal of Hitler contributed to the West's underestimation syndrome, as they call it. In other words, he portrayed Hitler as nothing but a clown, and basically a harmless clown, someone who danced with a balloon, maybe even likable in a funny Chaplin-esque way.
Democracy stunk.
Democracy is fragrant.
Liberty stunk.
Liberty is odious.
People in the West, who at that very moment had to decide whether to resist Hitler or not, would say, oh, why bother? He's just a funny little comic tramp. And that Chaplin, in fact, contributed to Hitler's success by trivializing him.
And then after the war, and after all was known about Hitler, did he then transcend the possibility of parody because of the horror that he had unleashed?
I think that there are problems in the representation of Hitler in general, because if you try to represent him straight on, inevitably you kind of humanize him. You know, you give him a psychological depth, or you suggest that he had a troubled childhood. On the other hand, as in Downfall, you can go too far and dehumanize him and make him unrealistic, as if evil were just some psychopathic manifestation. I think we have a real problem with it, and not surprising that we should, because Hitler, in a world of relativism, is sort of like the fixed pole of evil, where you could say, well, I don't know whether this is evil or that is evil, but Hitler is evil. And of course, that itself has lent itself to abuse, as the well-known Godwin's Law has illustrated.
Well, let's talk about Godwin's Law, the principle that suggests that once you mention Hitler, the discussion, whatever the discussion is over.
Godwin's Law grew out of the tendency of commenters on blogs to always take things to the Hitler level. And in a sense, once you do that, it ends all discussion, because beyond that, where do you go?
Once someone invokes Hitler, then that means the possibility for rational discussion has come to an end?
Well, I don't think that one should therefore rule out Hitler from being a referent in any historical argument. I think there are silly and pernicious ways of introducing Hitler into an argument, the way many of the Tea Partiers will draw Hitler mustaches on Obama. And it's offensive in a way to Hitler's victims to claim that these people who feel they're overtaxed are somehow victim of a tyranny akin to Hitler.
If not enough time has passed for Hitler to become a figure of parody, how much time do you need, and how have some people somehow gotten around it, like Mel Brooks and the producers?
You know, I find that Mel Brooks movie to be a great mystery in a way. How did he do it? I didn't find it offensive. I found Springtime for Hitler when they burst into song hilarious.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
It was the very disparity between what everyone knew was the genuineness of Hitler's horror and his evil, and the fatuousness of show business that was being really parodied and maligned that made it work.
The whole thing is infused with a Jewish sensibility, obviously. So there's a certain element of revenge in that film.
Or survival, in a sense, that the fact that Jewish culture can do this indicates that its spirit has not been destroyed by Hitler. The producers came out in 64, and the Eichmann trial was in 61, and that in some way was the first post-war international media foregrounding of Hitler's crimes, which made it more daring, and I still find it an amazing feat.
So what moment are we in now? Is there a right way to use Hitler satirically to talk about something in our current lives?
Well, I think it's wrong to make rules about art. I think that the watchword for everyone should be something that Emil Fackenheim, who was a brilliant Jewish philosopher, said to me when I was doing my Hitler book, which is, we should give to Hitler no posthumous victories.
Mel Brooks gave no posthumous victory to Hitler.
I agree.
Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Ron Rosenbaum, a columnist for Slate, is author of Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origins of His Evil, and a forthcoming book on the new age of nuclear war. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more help from Dylan Keefe. Katja Rogers is our senior producer. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.